Whenever I explore the land of yin, I always take one on the chin. And now this lioness has almost made me tame. I can't pronounce her name, but eggplant is her game. Lady sticks to me like white on rice. She never cooks the same way twice. Maybe it's the mushrooms, maybe the tomatoes. I can't reveal her name, but eggplant is her game. When my baby cooks her eggplant, she don't read no book. She's got a Gioconda kind of dirty look. And my baby cooks her eggplant about 19 different ways. Sometimes I just have it raw with mayonnaise.
Hello and welcome to Your Homegrown Food. I'm your host, Wonder Fox. This is a show about all things food. And you are tuned into 101.1 FM, Santa Cruz, freakradio.org. And 2 weeks ago, I played a conversation between David Kessler and Michael Pollan, but I was not able to get through the whole thing, so I'm going to finish playing that for you now. Michael Pollan is a journalist who has written extensively about food, including his latest book, Food Rules. And David Kessler is a pediatrician, lawyer, author, and he was the commissioner of the FDA. He most recently has written a book called The End of Overeating. So let's see, here we go with this conversation between David Kessler and Michael Pollan.
Do the same question, Michael, if I may. If you had the executives here and you felt that you had the FDA willing to do things other than get rid of
the food executives?
Yeah, what would you do? What would you suggest?
I think that's a really important question, actually, for everybody to answer. Is like every major food company will be in the next year or two coming to you, coming to Michelle Obama, and saying, how can we be part of the solution? And crafting that ask, I think you have to be really clever about it, because they're really smart. And they have made all sorts of deals, Clinton's deal on the soda machines, the Smart Choices deal they made with Tufts, that have completely backfired. So I think we have to be very careful that we ask for transformative things, or they can't be part of this conversation. I feel very strongly that, you know, I'm not interested in incrementally better breakfast, sweetened breakfast cereals. I just don't want to play that game. Now, you know, I don't have to. I'm not a policymaker, but this is not a winning, you know, the reformulation of heavily processed food. I realize having less salt and less sugar is probably a good idea, but be careful going down that path. I think the more important change is what you're talking about, is changing the culture so that eating that way is simply not acceptable to lots of people. Now, policy changes have an effect on the culture. When you could no longer smoke in restaurants and bars, I think that that was a driver in changing the how people felt about smoking, whether it was a socially acceptable activity or not. But I think that changing the culture is really important, and that's why the work that Alice does is so transformative. I mean, her idea of a delicious meal, her idea that ingredients should trump, you know, processing and technique, those are very powerful ideas, and she's changed the ideal of what a delicious meal is for a lot of people. Not for everybody. She's not reaching the entire culture, sad to say.
But when you say, then what do you want, where does the food industry fit into this?
Yeah, what do you think?
Well, so when you realize if you're a global multinational company, right, and your objective is growth in order to keep your stock price, and growth means greater sales, and greater sales, greater revenue means selling more food, increasing the caloric burden, whether it's useful or not. I mean,
it's a business model problem.
And the business model, make no mistake, it's been to take sugar, fat, and salt and put it every 20 feet.
Right.
And make it available 24/7.
And destroy the food culture. Teach us that a fourth daily meal is socially acceptable, as Taco Bell is now doing. Teach us that fast food is a legitimate form of diet, as these companies are doing. So the advertising marketing piece, I think, is a big part of it.
Let me just go there for a moment. Do you put curbs on the advertising marketing?
To children, you do.
So understand that over the next 20 years, I mean, it's going to be one of the great, you know, litigated issues. And certainly with the current composition of the Supreme Court, we're not going to get there. I mean, on a 5-4 vote. We're going to have to change the way we view advertising. If you view advertising as neutral speech for a product, right, you're not going to be able to regulate. If you understand that there are certain products, right, that are reinforcing and that the advertising associated with them, it's not just neutral speech, right, but a way that amplifies it and increases the reinforcing potential of that product. And those products are special.
We've already had a Supreme Court ruling, though. I mean, it's been laid down. It is free speech in terms of corporations being individuals.
But again, you will have a whole series of cases starting with the FDA tobacco rules that have not yet gone before the Supreme Court. I mean, I think in the end, we're going to have to be able to make a case that food is not just any commodity. That if you want to, advertise a car, right, or you want to advertise paint, you know, those are commodities. But food, especially food that is reinforcing, I mean, that advertising has a real effect on behavior, but that's a case that's not been made, and I'm not sure this generation of the Supreme Court is going to be able to get that.
Especially not if your friend is right and we're toast already. I mean, Michael, are you comfortable with the idea of, obviously, we're all in favor, I think. I could tell most of the audience, if not all the audience, and certainly the three of us, favor more regulation where children are concerned. But what about regulation of advertising?
Well, I think health claims on you know, food packages, I think we really have to look at that. I don't think that that is really, from a public health point of view, I think it's been a disaster. I mean, I think that, you know, I mentioned earlier, you know, picking props out. It's outrageous what's on the front of cereal boxes. I mean, we just succeeded in taking off because of San Francisco, I think, attorney's office. But they were advertising cereal as a preventative for swine flu all winter long with this immunity banner. And it was a lawyer at the, I believe, at the San Francisco City Attorney's office who threatened them with action unless they took it off, and they removed it. I think we have to take another look at what is permissible on food packages because the lying that's going on these packages is just outrageous.
But it even gets to there's a more fundamental point. I mean, I have good friends and highly respected at FDA, and talking about, I don't know if you've seen the discussion about traffic lights,
right? The English system.
The English system on the front of the product. When you think about it, though, right? I mean, the vast majority of stuff we're eating is highly processed. I mean, how could you ever put a green light on those products? I think we did. I think I agree with you. I think the health claim, certainly on the front of the package, we made a mistake. We try to say if there was significant scientific agreement that those claims could be made. But the fact is, being able to accentuate one aspect of positive without imbalance, I mean, all the negatives of the products just leads to misinformation.
A lot of the science is not what we call absolute where food is concerned anyway. I mean, some of it's still kind of murky. And I mean, there's still people who say global warming doesn't exist or climate change doesn't exist. I'm not talking about that kind of pseudoscience or wrong-headed science. I'm just talking about really science that hasn't culminated in the kind of absolutes that you would like to have empirically.
Well, I've been hard on nutrition scientists in my work. And, I mean, I've said that the nutrition science is pretty much where surgery was in the year 1650, which is a little harsh, but there's a lot of truth in it.
But apt, yeah.
But there is, but I think that's not the language in which to talk to people about food. I think we've had 40 years of talking about nutrients to people. And everybody walks around with a head full of biochemistry. They talk like they know what an antioxidant is. And, you know, saturated fat and omega-3s, omega-6s. This is not the proper vocabulary. This is the vocabulary you may need to use in your work, and biologists certainly need to use, but it's not the language, I don't think, that is very helpful to individuals in talking about food. I mean, I think the most important distinction is between real food and what I call edible food-like substances, between processed food and real food. I think we've got to get it that simple, and that's where you bring about some cultural change. Is that real food, or is that this other stuff?
But, I mean, it's hard, right? Because I have it here, okay? Where was it? Don't eat anything your great-grandmother won't recognize as food. Right? Will you autograph this after? but the fact is, it's complicated because we are living longer.
Yeah.
Right? Than the average length of life. And certainly not everything that my great-grandmother ate as food would, if you look at coronary artery disease or other things.
I'm not so sure about that duck fat. But we can talk about that. One of the problems.
Alice, you want to settle?
It's wonderful stuff, duck fat.
But she wasn't eating mostly plants.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
So,
yeah.
I mean,
I think that food traditions are interesting. Some of them are hard to recover, however. I mean, the fact is, even people who are eating a lot of meat 100 years ago, we're not eating the meat we're eating. So it's very hard to go back to that. So in other words, the chicken fat, the schmaltz, came from chickens who were outside eating bugs and grass, and it was a very different substance.
So I will tell you a story. Here in this wonderful city with this wonderful, you know, the food that we're privileged to have. So I went in, I read your books, and there was a burger there, grass-fed, raised with grass-fed.
Neiman Ranch.
Right. Grass-fed. There it was, grass-fed burger, and I ordered it. Sorry. Right? So I ate it, and it was it tasted real good. So I said, the grass-fed burger was great. I said to one of the people in the restaurant, I said, you know, this is great. What is it about this grass-fed beef that is so wonderful? And she, without missing a beat, she says, oh, we add 25% beef fat.
I'll tell you the rest of
the afterwards.
No. Well, I'm glad we got a little levity here. We need it. David alluded to your seven words. There are people who may not know those seven words.
Oh, and this is
just good, practical wisdom from Michael Pollan.
Well, this is after 2 years of studying nutrition science and trying to come up with, what do we really know about the links between diet and health? And I realized that it came down to, it was pretty simple. Eat food, not too much, mostly plants. And that those seven words, which don't have any kind of nutrients in them and don't have any science behind them, are pretty good guidance. Not that they're easy, because distinguishing food from edible food-like substances is very tricky in this marketplace. And not too much, as you've eloquently explained, is perhaps the hardest of all. But if you kind of operate under that umbrella, you'll do all right. I mean, I'm really trying hard to simplify a message that's gotten too complex, and more complex than it needs to be, and to find a language, and that's why I did this little book. This book was suggested, actually, by public health professionals and doctors who said, we really want a pamphlet we can give to our patients, who don't want to read a whole book of science, who don't need to know the history of foreign policy in America, who just want to know how to eat. And so I tried to boil it down to 64 rules. We'll see if that's a good approach. I'm very interested in how we create messages around this, because I think we know what we need to know to eat well. So then the question becomes, as you said, a cultural question.
So rules,
a storytelling question.
Let me ask you what your message would be. I mean, I'm trying to get a sense of, you don't have to necessarily boil it down to seven words, but if you had a message that you wanted to be as pithy about as you could with respect to eating, Michael kind of suggested maybe not, just don't eat too much, or what would you say?
I think I agree with that message.
That's a given.
I agree with that, and I think you hit it right on the head. I think that it's also very important to understand what's going on in our heads, at least for a lot of people, not everybody. Right? And if you don't have a problem, resisting foods, and you can eat three quarters of a, and just stop and. Right? Those are the people I really want to scan, their brains, right, and understand. But for the vast majority of American people who have a hard time, stopping, right, or looking at that pizza box and there's one slice and you're sitting there with friends and you're thinking to yourself, am I going to get that or not? Right? If you don't live in that world, you have no idea what I'm talking about. Will you tell me whether you're part, which camp you're in?
It's funny. I'm a one bite of dessert will do it person.
Yeah. The real issue here. Now, we've gotten this, okay? Because there's about 15% of the population who would just as well take their food, as a pill. It's not a. It just doesn't call out. And, I mean, it's really that 15%.
That's just dessert.
That's just dessert.
The rest of it's
That's me. So the message, it's how this calls out to you, right, and how this works, right? And it's this cue-induced wanting. So it's based on past learning. It's not a message. And give me the seven words, okay? But let me just describe it for you, and then tell me what I'm saying, right? based on past experience and past learning, we get cued. Right? It could be the sight. It could be smell. So somebody was telling me they were driving past a McDonald's. They had never been into McDonald's, and they only started thinking about was the Chinese chicken salad at McDonald's because the taste, right, had appeared in the mouth. I mean, it was just, they were cued.
David, I think I can boil it down to four words for you, maybe. Shut off the circuitry.
But you can't, if you do that, understand that circuitry. You talked about addiction when you started. That involves the learning, memory, motivational, and habit circuits of our brains. You can't shut off that circuitry. We can shut it off, but I'd be dead. Right? So what Alice is saying, and I think what you're saying, is you got to substitute. Right? Because that circuitry, I mean, I got to want something, so what is it that I'm going to want? But you have to understand, why am I eating when I'm not hungry? I never understood that.
I actually said on the air today, in talking about food addiction, such as it is, and the obesity epidemic, when I found out I had diabetes, I changed my eating habits because I had to change my eating habits. I realized I was that much more vulnerable to stroke and that much more vulnerable to a heart attack. And consequently, I think that you can actually change the circuitry. When I wanted to quit smoking, I went cold turkey because my father said, "You've never done anything for. I've never asked you to do anything in my life. I may never, as long as I live, but I want you to quit smoking." It was enough of an incentive to quit smoking. There's something that can propel you to change your circuitry.
So absolutely, right? And something in both those examples, there was meaning attached, right? And that meaning resonated with you, and that meaning made, really had an effect on your emotional circuitry, and you were able to substitute that for all this other stuff you were eating. So it was just a question, the problem is if you just say cut it out or change your eating and you don't have that same emotional reactivity to it, right, it's not going to work. That's why diets don't work. If you just deprive yourself, sure, for 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, you can lose the weight. But then you go back into your environment. You haven't changed your brain. You haven't changed what has meaning, what has resonance for you. You get cued again. And, of course, you're going to gain the weight back.
We've got to wrap it up. But, Michael and I were talking about the guy from Yale, Barrow.
Charlie Brownell?
Yeah, who has this whole thing about mindfulness with eating. And maybe that's another way of saying meaning. But he talks about, it's almost a Buddhistic practice where you are mindful of what you eat, you're cognitive. At the same time, you bring your emotions into it, and it actually can change and alter, again, circuitry, as I think David's calling it. I mean, I want to leave on the end of hope here because I got the note from Harold that we got to wrap it up. But what I want to say, again, is it's always a pleasure talking to these two. Congratulations to both of them for much-deserved honor and recognition that they got here today. Thanks to all of you.
That was a conversation between Michael Pollan and David Krasny. Michael Pollan is a food, an author who has written, and a journalist who has written a lot about food. And David Krasny is also an author who wrote The End of Overeating. And it looks like we have a phone call. So let's see if I can answer this phone. Oh my goodness, phone. How do I do this? Hi, caller. You're on the air.
Hi. Oh, I don't need to be on the air.
Well, I'm in the middle of a show, so...
Okay, I'll call back.
Okay.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
All righty. The next thing I was going to talk about in the last few minutes is fresh fruit. This is the time of year to eat the best, most loveliest, most wonderful fresh fruit. So go to the farmer's market and get yourself some. Yum, yum. The reason I brought it up is because I ate a delicious fruit dessert the other night, and I wanted to tell you all about it so you can try it too. Very yummy and simple. I had mascarpone cheese. Not sure how to say that, mascarpone or mascarpone cheese, with delicious, lovely, fresh figs, the first figs of the season, and toasted pine nuts. And it was yummy. And you can eat that mascarpone cheese with any kind of fruit, and I'm sure it would be equally as delicious. So go out and get yourself some mascarpone and some fresh fruit from the farmer's market and try it. Yum, yum, yum. And the other thing I wanted to talk about is an important gardening item for this time of year. I wanted to tell you about late blight. If you grow tomatoes or potatoes in your garden, then you want to listen to this. Late blight, or it's also called tomato blight, affects tomato plants and also potato plants. And it's becoming an issue in the U.S. In a lot of states, it's really not good, not a good thing. It's killing people's tomato plants in a lot of other states in the country. And I think it's also becoming an issue in California. So if you garden here, you need to be aware of it. And the signs that your tomato plants have late blight are brown spots on the leaves. And if you turn the leaves over, you'll see some white sort of mold spores, I think they are. And also it can affect the stems of the plants. And you need to take care of this problem right away if you find that your tomato plants have late blight or tomato blight, because it travels through the air, and it can affect other people's tomato plants. If you have it and you don't take care of it, it'll get up into the airstream and travel through the air and land on other people's tomatoes, and that's not good. You don't want to give your neighbors tomato blight. So what you need to do if you find that your tomatoes have late blight, go out in your garden and rip out your plants and put them in a bag and seal the bag and throw that bag into your garbage and have it go to the landfill. Don't try to compost tomato plants that have late blight. Bad, bad, bad. Because it overwinters in the plant or possibly in the soil. I think actually it overwinters in the plant. So if you compost the plant, it just stays in the plant, even if the plant composts. And especially if you compost tomatoes that have late blight, and then you put the compost on your garden, and then the seeds in those tomatoes sprout, those little seedlings can carry late blight. So if you had late blight last year and you did such a thing, you put tomato plants or tomatoes in your compost and then put it on your garden, and those little seedlings sprout, pull them out and throw them away, because they can carry late blight. And this is really, really important. So if you know other people who grow tomatoes, please tell them to keep an eye out for tomato blight and take care of it right away. So the best thing to prevent it is just watch out for it and keep your garden really clean. No tomato sprouts, and get rid of the damaged plants right away if you find them. And don't compost plants that have tomato blight, and tell all your friends, watch out for tomato blight, because it's becoming a terrible epidemic in the country, and home gardeners should be able to grow tomatoes, because they're one of my favorite things to grow, and most people, I think, who garden at home love to grow tomatoes. It's one of the best things to eat from your garden, so it would be a shame if late blight became a real problem and people couldn't grow tomatoes. Also, another sign is that if your tomatoes have rotten spots or brown spots on them, that can also be a sign. If you didn't take your plant out and it got affected and then it grew tomatoes, the tomatoes also get affected and they're no good. So, do that. If you're a home gardener, go ahead and take care of it and tell your friends. So if you would like to get more information about anything I talked about on the show, or if you'd like to listen to the conversation between Michael Pollan and David Kessler again, go to my Facebook page, Your Homegrown Food Show. You can Google it. If you just Google Facebook, Your Homegrown Food Show, you'll find the link to my page, and there's all kinds of good information there about food and gardening and such, and there's a link to that conversation, and there's also an article that I posted about late blight, which has more information about tomato blight, and you can forward that to your friends and take care of your tomato plants. And you are listening to Your Homegrown Food. I'm your host, Wander Fox, and you're tuned into 101.1 FM in Santa Cruz and freakradio.org on the internet. And we are here with this show on the air every Wednesday from 11:30 to 12. So tune us in every week to get more great information about what's going on in the world of food. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in this week. Hope you enjoyed the show, and I will speak with you all next week. So stay tuned now for Democracy Now!
Explore the land of yin. I always take one on the chin. And now this lioness has almost made me tame. I can't pronounce her name, but eggplant is her game. The lady sticks to me like white on rice. She never cooks the same way twice. Maybe it's the mushrooms, maybe the tomatoes. I can't reveal her name, but eggplant is her game. When my baby cooks her eggplant, she don't read no book. She's got a Gioconda kind of dirty look. And my baby cooks her eggplant about 19 different ways. Sometimes I just have it raw with mayonnaise.
From the cream to the dregs. From the cream to the dregs.